Today on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa, a conversation on the challenges of the fight against the coronavirus pandemic in Africa. That discussion is coming up next on Straight Talk Africa. Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees. So our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future, as we, out of an abundance of caution, reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We are working to help keep you informed, and we appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, you are welcome to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia. And the discussion for today is the African reaction to the corona pandemic. And joining us are two distinguished guests. One of them is Dr. Munini Murera, a doctor with a real clinic, not like me here. He's also a columnist for The Monitor, an independent Ugandan daily newspaper. He joins us from Toronto, Canada. And last but not least, we are joined by another doctor with a real clinic, Dr. Amit Thakkar, the chairman of the Africa Healthcare Federation. He joins us via Skype from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. I have to say, Dr. Munini Murera and Dr. Amit Thakkar, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Ndugu Shaka. Thank you for inviting me. And you look great, man.
It's absolutely a pleasure, Shaka, to be with you.
Let me ask you the first question. What is your immediate reaction to this pandemic, really?
This is extremely serious. And it is something that I am deeply concerned about, because it brings memories of what I never saw, but read about, learned about, and heard about. And that was the 1918-1920 pandemic of what was called the Spanish flu. It also reminds me of something that you and I, as young boys, we heard about, called Ruahindia, which was the terrible pandemic that hit particularly the Indian subcontinent in 1957. And they had very high mortalities. So this one coming so fast as it has, and everything that we are learning about this new coronavirus suggests that it is one of the most serious threats against humanity. But at the same time, I do not have the morbid fear that some people have. I recognize that humanity has the capacity to defeat these pandemics. And I am beginning to be encouraged by the efforts that I see around the world to do just that.
Talk to us very briefly about the reaction of the Africa Healthcare Federation to the fight against the coronavirus pandemic on the continent.
The reaction is really a sense of urgency has set in. The reaction is realizing that we don't have time. Since Africa is running out of time, we're trying to build partnerships with all the stakeholders, including government, to try and stop the spread of this virus. Literally, we are trying to put all pieces in place, from business to society to NGOs to government. So we're trying to really do whatever we can. The biggest problem is resources. We want to get enough resources to ensure that we have protection so we stop the transmission. So the reaction is rally the support, rally the partnership, and rally the advocacy to try and save more lives in Africa. That's the reaction for the Africa Healthcare Federation.
My brother, when you talk about resources, what exactly are you talking about here? Are we talking about personal protection equipment? Are we talking about the testing infrastructure? What exactly are we talking about here?
Right. There are so many. So in the first phase is obviously prevention. So everything you talked about in personal protective equipment is critical. Testing and getting the right testing kits are important. Making sure if there are any treatment available that we have the right treatment in time. And understanding that we would like, when we have issues like lockdown or suppressed movement in countries, we have enough food for the vulnerable population. The vulnerable population is becoming a very important aspect of our containment measures in Africa. So we do need all these supplies. But in addition to that, we also need human resources for health. We need the right amount of doctors, nurses, and we are a little concerned that if we see them getting affected and being infected, we will lose already the slim and the small number of human resources that are out there in the front line. So there are plenty of challenges we have that we have to deal with in this virus outbreak in Africa.
What about some people who are saying you are probably talking about another virus, just like the flu, influenza? What is the difference, if you were to talk to us from the deepest bitter part of the bottom of your covered heart and soul, what is the difference between the coronavirus and the flu as we know it?
So first of all, those who say it is just a virus, just like the flu, they miss an important point, that even flu that comes along every year is a serious disease. It's very serious, and that is why we strongly recommend that people take measures to protect themselves from the so-called ordinary flu. Here in North America, vaccines are offered against influenza every year, and we do hope that more and more people will take them and accept them. But that said, this new coronavirus is in its own league. This particular virus has a very rapid rate of spread. The epidemiologists talk about a number called the R0, a basic number that reflects the rate at which a virus will spread from one person to others. Mm-hmm. And whereas for the common flu, the figure is around 1.3, a rate of that, imagine this one, it is at least double the rate of spread within a community. And you have seen it here in North America. It pretty much arrived in the United States sometime in early January there. And now 3 months later, look at what it has done to states like New York, what it did to California, to Washington State. Here in Canada, where things are not as severe as you have seen them in Italy or the United States, we still have very high numbers, now well over 10,000 people infected. So this is a rapidly spreading condition. But also, it doesn't just give you a common flu where you cough, have a fever, have a headache, you are unwell, and you probably recover unless you have certain other risk factors. This one seems to hit particularly the lungs and has a very high inflammatory process, or a way of bruising the lungs, depriving you of the ability to absorb oxygen.
What would you say is your assessment in as far as both the African governments and the stakeholders are measuring up in the context of fighting the virus?
Look, they have, in the month of March, I would say Africa woke up, could have woken up in January or February, but I think the African governments are fighting very hard. There are a few countries which I can use as examples. Liberia is doing really well. So is Ghana, and so is Kenya, in a country I'm in. We have a strong public-private partnership. We are so detailed, we're so integrated with each other that our actions totally supplement that of the government. Our Minister for Health, Honorable Mutahi Kagwe, has also been singled out by the Wall Street Journal as one of the champions of Africa. When three countries were mentioned, Singapore, UK, and Kenya, as being the trailblazers in the containment strategy of COVID, one of the attributes that I can say we're involved in is how the private sector is partnering with the government in order to contain this strategy. And the numbers speak for itself. We know that the big wave is coming, but the foundation of partnerships and collaboration is getting stronger every day.
Now, when you talk about the three countries that seem to be doing very well, what would you say is the secret behind those three countries, Liberia, Ghana, and Kenya?
I think leadership. It's literally leadership and reaching out to stakeholders. If governments think they can do it by themselves, they are in for a big trouble very soon. So I think leadership is the thing that sets them apart. This is not leadership at presidential level, but it's also leadership at Ministry of Health level. This is the time when deputies will be counted in the country and probably not the principals. When you have strong deputies and strong team members, you will see a success formula for Africa in the numbers that are seen. It's about togetherness, and those who realize how to work together are going to save more people in the country than others.
There are, by the way, several people in our audience who would like to ask you some questions so that you could share your wisdom with them regarding the coronavirus pandemic. One of these is Maria, and she is from Hargeisa, Somaliland.
How can we prevent and also prepare ourselves so that we can reduce the death rates and also the incident rates of COVID-19?
The personal discipline of hand washing. Hand washing with water and soap for at least 20 seconds. Second, social distancing. Making sure that you are at least 2 meters away from other people except your intimate partner in order to minimize the risk of person-to-person contact. Three, using face coverings, either with masks that are homemade or whatever face covering one can, not to protect yourself, but to protect the others in order to reduce the extent of spread of this. And four, I would suggest that we strengthen our health services. We work together as a society in order to do this, because this virus is going to be around for some time. And we need also to maintain optimal health ourselves, healthy nutrition, avoid excessive consumption of alcohol, make sure you exercise, make sure your body is in a state to deal with the virus if and when it comes.
There is a question that was asked by one member of the audience. Is called Geta Q from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. But it is pretty much like the first question I asked to you, really.
How is the coronavirus different from other viruses like flu and others?
So it's, I think we have addressed that, but it is how this coronavirus, the things it triggers, the processes within the lungs, within the kidneys and other key organs that it triggers, that result in more severe, more destructive inflammation or bruising of those organs are in particularly in high-risk individuals.
We have another question from Tinoziva of Zimbabwe.
Does it really affect young children or teenagers, or it's only for adults?
So we know that it affects all age groups. We do not have adequate data to tell us, to answer the last part of his question, whether it is affecting them equally in numbers. But what we know in terms of severity, children do way, way better. The majority of them seem to have a milder disease. The youngest child reported was 30 hours of age, so about 1 day old. And throughout the childhood age group, they have been reported with good outcomes so far.
There's another question, and the last one from the audience, from Abigail Sidi from Kenya.
My questions to the doctors is this. It is rumored that in areas with warmer climates, like in Africa and Kenya, the spread of coronavirus is quite slow. So I'd like to know whether this is true or false.
The jury is still out on that one. When one looks at the numbers in Africa, one wonders why it is that we have been relatively lucky so far. But this is a complex subject where you have to look at the number of people who came from outside who would have potentially brought it into those countries. And you look at the population distributions and so on. I think the summer months are going to be indicators here in the temperate world. We'll see what happens to this virus. What is very intriguing coming out of that question, though, is when you look at Africa itself, the differences in numbers reported, you wonder. You then look at some of the West Africa's numbers, and then you look at East Africa's numbers, you wonder. You look at what is happening in Ecuador, an equatorial country in South America, where they've had high numbers and high death rates. Then you look at us in East Africa, more or less on the same latitude, and we are not doing as badly. So it's too complex, I think, to a question at the moment to be answered.
Very interesting, Dr. Takar. What about the issue of numbers? Africa is more than 1.3 billion human beings, and yet the numbers of those people infected seem to be very, very low. Is that because of a reflection, for example, of adequate testing, or is it perhaps a reflection of what is going around, that this particular virus is not necessarily an enemy of the African people? There are some people who are claiming that this particular virus, when it comes to warm weathers, when it comes to areas that are warm, that are hot, that it tends to spread very slowly. Is there any scientific evidence to back that claim up?
That's a very good question. And Shaka, we are learning new things every day about coronavirus. There was a talk about warm weather, but there's a lot of studies coming out that it's not the warm weather that's protecting the spread of virus. Look at Australia, for example. When they had hot temperatures, they still had a transmission chain that was ongoing. People have talked about BCG vaccinations, just hoping that BCG will provide a protective shield. But to be honest, there isn't any scientific evidence on these claims because it's fairly new and we are learning new things about this virus all the time. Now, talking about the 1.3 billion people in Africa, as you know, we were probably the late continent on receiving coronavirus when we got our first case in Egypt, and then we had some in North Africa, Algeria, Morocco, and then South Africa. It shows you it was brought in by travelers. And since the bulk of traveling and air traffic happens in Europe and maybe in US, this is what we are seeing as a pattern that may have made Africa the late continent to receive the virus. But having said that, we have seen pockets of this virus spreading in urban cities that you've seen in Accra, you've seen in Addis Ababa, you've seen in Nairobi, and this is where they are the main airports. And these cases that were detected first were imported. Look, you've also got to see the number of deaths. And if you look at the number of people who are dying in the US and in Europe, it tells you that the virus has spread pretty much widely. We are not seeing those many deaths in Africa. So even if we didn't test enough, we know that we're not seeing mortality and we're not seeing patients coming into the hospital dying of this virus having not been tested. So I say that we need to ramp up testing. We are not testing enough, but the numbers seem to be accurate as far as the reporting is concerned in most of the cities, as we see.
That is a strong possibility as well. If you do not test, you will have low numbers on paper. That doesn't mean you don't have low numbers in reality, but you would have thought that the health services in the African countries, take Uganda for example, would have been reporting these illnesses that look like COVID-19, even when they have not done the testing. So it's too complex a subject at the moment to reduce to rather simplistic answers. I think that we need to await data. We need to get studies and see what the public health departments in those countries are showing, what the WHO is showing, before we can address that more confidently.
Earlier, you talked about the need for resources, and I have information for you that when it comes to Ghana, there is a professor who has actually been able to build a ventilator, or ventilators for that matter. Do you have any specific examples that are contributions or unique contributions from Kenya and Liberia to the fight against the virus?
We have many examples, and I am so impressed with the innovation in many African countries. In Kenya, we've got students from the Kenyatta University who've developed a prototype which will ventilate a patient using a mechanical structure. We've got people who've innovated a bicycle chain that will press the ambu bag to push oxygen so that patients can receive the oxygen what they need. We've got ambulance and emergency systems in Liberia that are innovative to ensure that people reach hospitals in good time. So like Ghana, like Kenya, like many other countries, I'm sure, are innovating and improvising with the tools that they have at their disposal in the country to try and bring critical care. And it's not only critical care about ventilation, but it's also about infrastructure. Architects, planners are designing use of containers that are idle to ensure that the COVID zones can admit patients without transmitting this disease to the other patients in the hospital. We've got lawyers working to provide a nice legal structure. We have even people like the hospital CEOs coming together to create a preparedness program on how to handle the upsurge of patients. So I think there's a lot of innovation in the critical care, like ventilators, it's obvious, but there's also innovation around services like telemedicine and telehealth. And infrastructure and so on and so forth. So I think Africa is on the move, and I hope this ends really soon, because Africa is going to be stronger if we don't have an upsurge, because it will have boosted innovation and also local manufacturing, repurposing their rusty machines or machines that were not being used to start stitching masks or protective overalls and headgears. That's what I can see happening in Africa.
One of the efforts that have been used to apparently slow down the pandemic in Asia, in Europe, and North America is said to be the adoption of what they characterize as essentially what they call social distancing. Is that something that could work in Africa, in a continent where the culture is about extended relationship, where everybody is done, everything is almost done within the context of the community, as opposed to the individual? You recall that a former American first lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton, wrote a book whose title is "It Takes a Village to Raise a Child in Africa." As a matter of fact, it seems to me that it actually takes that same village, that same community, to sustain life in Africa.
I agree that it's a very difficult situation. We cannot easily copy and paste approaches to a condition like the coronavirus pandemic. We are, however, dealing with a condition that can have absolutely devastating effects on any society, regardless of its economic status. And particularly in Africa, where our healthcare systems are so wanting, many of them have regressed way, way, way back to a state that really is most discouraging. If we should have an outbreak of sick, critically ill people, we can't handle them. I am very familiar with my home country, Uganda. A population of 40 million or so, with only 55 critical care beds in the entire country. 55. But, and it is not unique to Uganda. It's really across most of the continent that we have focused on things that don't matter, and we have left undone what we ought to have done. And that is to invest in healthcare precisely for a situation like this.
Hi, everyone. It's Taco Fall. I just wanted to say that now's the time to practice kindness and empathy towards everyone around you. We all doing our best to get through this together, so make sure you do your part. Grab a book, read it to your nieces and nephews on video chat, make a donation of canned goods to your local food bank, or even add some items to your shopping cart for your elderly neighbors. But most importantly, don't forget to just pick up the phone and call somebody and check in. That may mean a lot. You never know. We all can be next to each other right now, but we still can show how much we care about one another. So visit mbatogether.com and join us in inspiring acts of caring. Thank you.
Hello, you're welcome back to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, which is coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia. Our topic for today is the African reaction to the coronavirus pandemic. And our guests are Dr. Munini Molera from Toronto, Canada, and Dr. Amit Thacker from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. To what extent is social distancing effective on the ground in Africa, especially given that when it comes to culture, it could probably pose a problem because Africans tend to do a lot of things together. The African society is pretty much structured along a community as opposed to the individual.
Look, it's very difficult, and I think all the leaders, policymakers are dealing with social distancing as a challenge. But education plays a key role, and I've seen a dramatic change, especially when it comes to shaking hands and greeting. That was the first part of the societal engagement that I saw working on social distancing. So social distancing becomes more difficult, especially in crowded places, but education, as I was saying, is playing a very important role, and people have stopped shaking hands. People are now managing to wear masks. They are keeping distances, especially in offices. It's when you have crowded places that becomes really difficult to manage social distancing. Many people say social distancing is a privilege in Africa.
So what about then the issue of washing your hands with soap every so often? How can that possibly be done in the Africa that you seem to be describing?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we are now in that situation. I think we can spend a lot of time, as I see many Africans on the social media, lamenting what ought to have been done. I am no longer there personally. I am at the point of, all right, we are in the situation right now. How do we make the best and the most of it? For example, communities get together and they say, we are going to get our water in jerry cans or whatever. And this water is policed by the community to make sure that everyone has access to it. Soap is not expensive. This is where government resources could be spent to literally provide soap to people, knowing that some are going to sales and whatnot, but you do the best you can. To me, the bigger problem is that hand washing is actually a habit. It's a culture that we acquire over time. Those people who never bother to wash their hands may find it hard to remember to do so. So again, campaigns, whether using radios and the community leaders to keep reminding people to do this, to wash hands, social distance, identify individuals who may have symptoms, take themselves to the health facilities for testing, because this is about us as members of the community, not about someone out there to save us. It is ourselves as community members to take the initiative so that we individually and communally come out of this safely.
Very interesting. What are some of the lessons that you and your colleagues have learned out of this virus pandemic?
There are several lessons we've learned actually on this continent. One is that partnership between public and private is very crucial to strengthen the health system and to improve life expectancy for the people in Africa. I think working together is critical. With limited resources, both in public and in private, joining hands together is the best way to save us from this pandemic, but also from future pandemics. The second lesson we've learned is we should prepare to rebound back after COVID. We shouldn't lose hope. We should also be thinking of revitalization of our health systems and rebound of our economy. We should also start preparing for that. The third lesson we have learned is don't have over-reliance on people or, countries outside Africa. Don't over-rely, say, on China for trade or whether it's India for trade. Intra-Africa trade is also very important. We should open up borders and have free continental trade. That will boost our local manufacturing and it will create more jobs. And this is also another learning that we have learned. We've learned also to retain our professionals within Africa by creating an environment, a professional environment, an enabling environment for them to thrive in a growing economy. We are learning all the time. It's the new normal. We have learned so much within a period of 2 months, not only the leaders in private sector, but also leaders in government have learned so much on how to think about fiscal policies, what it means about creating and retaining people in jobs, about taxation and monetary policies, about reducing expenses and being innovative, and more importantly, how to look after each other together when we are staying at home and staying safe.
Dr. Mnini Morera, what about some who say, yes, the coronavirus is a very bad thing. It's a very bad scourge. It's killing a lot of people. It's destroying economies and what have you. But that when it comes to Africa, that maybe there might be something good that may come out of it. That good, according to these observers, is that a lot of African elite, government officials, and the people with money normally go either abroad or overseas for medical checkup, precisely because they have not put in place a viable, adequate medical care infrastructure. Given the fact that most countries have basically closed their borders, closed their boundaries, their airports, to flights from overseas and abroad, even though, of course, the virus has no respect for borders or boundaries. Could this perhaps become a sort of incentive that may, in fact, make these decision makers in most of these African countries pay immediate attention, a sort of the fierce urgency of now, of making sure that they put in place functional, adequate medical care infrastructure to sustain them?
Absolutely. And in fact, I am beginning to detect evidence of that. I have been watching President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda very closely since this situation arose. I must tell you, I am very impressed by his conduct so far. I have seen the Ugandan president literally showing he has his emotion in it. I have seen him actually respecting healthcare professionals in each and every one of the addresses he has given to the nation. He has ended up by thanking and acknowledging the healthcare professionals who are at the forefront of the struggle. His attitude towards them hitherto had been one of despising them. They were really inconsequential. But he has taken the lead because I think he recognizes that if this hit him or his family members or his soldiers, he has nowhere to fly them, and they have to be taken care of in Uganda. I suspect this is so in other capitals, and I'm hoping that these leaders will recognize that it is not just about COVID. It's about other conditions that require immediate attention. Make the healthcare services in your country so good that you are happy to be the first client in that hospital. The British Prime Minister was struck by this virus. He did not ask to be flown to California or to Paris. He was driven just around the corner to a hospital where he was cared for by professionals. Ironically, by the way, many of whom were not even British people. These were people who were trained elsewhere and are working in the United Kingdom, who, among whom are many, many, many Africans, who ought to be back in our countries serving our people if the conditions were right. Conditions of justice, human rights, democracy, freedom. and the healthcare services so that the governments are investing people's money where it matters. This is the time, I believe, for these governments to really sit down and think, the rulers to think about shifting their emphasis and their dollars, shift it from the guns, shift it from the instruments of oppression and control, shift it to the instruments of healing, of progress, of ensuring that every citizen, whether they are the president or a pauper, they get the best health care, the best social welfare, and so that they enjoy the life that God has given them as much as he has given to you in your state house.
Very interesting. What about the fact that Africa, since the 1884 Berlin Conference, is divided in 54, if you add Western Sahara, 55 countries, and yet here you are going against a virus which has absolutely no respect for borders or boundaries. What should Africa learn from there?
Look, because the virus does not need a visa to cross countries, and this is what we have to do, is to work hand in hand, be shoulder to shoulder with our policies. What works in Liberia should be shared with Ghana. What works in Kenya should be shared with Tanzania. And what works in Botswana could be shared with Cameroon. And what could be a danger in South Africa should be shared with Egypt or Algeria. And that's, I think, the collaboration that we need. We also have regional economic communities in Africa, as you are aware. So the East African community, the ECOWAS, the SADC, they should literally wear their boots now and work very strongly in containing this virus spread within the regions. Like you rightly said, it doesn't recognize borders. So if one country is having a high containment strategy, it could easily seep in from neighboring countries if we are not careful. So I think it's the togetherness that's going to keep us recover. It's going to make us recover to a stronger economy after COVID. That's what I think really we have to do. We have a continental strategy. And that's what Africa CDC really announced, that it's time for a continental strategy. President Cyril Ramaphosa was very emphatic about this. This is a fight. We need to keep Africa safe together.
What about the fact that African culture is very socially friendly? It is an extended type of relationship. Mm. Why can't we possibly do some more research so that we can perhaps reach a point where we can abolish these superficial borders and boundaries in order, in fact, to have a united Africa for those Africans who really, at the end of the day, need to be there for one another in the context of holding each other's backs?
Yeah, I think politics divides us. I mean, United States of Africa was a concept that was floated by the late Gaddafi, if you remember. And now we have a discussion around the African passport. So over time, I think people have created these political boundaries and have created a sense of sovereignty of each country. And because of the social culture that you mentioned, I think it's mooting an idea of first, let's start doing trade with each other. Let borders not divide us. The other thing in Africa is language. You know, we have Francophone and we have Anglophone sometimes, and we are letting the language also divide us.
And you have the Lusophone, you have the Lusophonicophone, and what about the Bantuphone for that matter?
That's correct. So all the phones that are there are sometimes creating those divisions. We have a lot of work to do, to be honest. It's very easy to say that we have one continent, one team, and one people. I think we've got to take this one step at a time. And the best way...
Go ahead.
Best way to do it is to start trade, keep any initiative that improves GDP and creates wealth within Africa by Africans. Then we start making ease of travel for people to move within the countries easily. And then we should have the ease of movement of goods. And these are ways that we can start becoming more social and more unified and learn each other's culture and maybe even language. So we've got a lot of work to do before we say the 54 and 55 countries are one. So step at a time, let's move towards the Agenda 2063 as outlined in the African Union.
Dr. Sakala, let's go back, or rather a little bit back to the measures of social distancing.
Mm-hmm.
Here in North America, and in Europe for that matter, social distancing has been effective largely because it has been accompanied by government measures of economic stimulus. We're mm-hmm. talking about providing a sort of socio-economic lifeline.
Mm.
Can you sincerely rely on social distancing in Africa, especially in the urban areas, where you do not accompany it with a sort of social stimulus, social economic lifeline? Because some people are already complaining, those who live in urban areas, that they now have to fight two viruses in their view. In their words, not mine, they now have to fight both the coronavirus and also starvation. They face starvation because they have nothing to really buy food.
You know, this, Shaka, is the challenge every day in the leaders' minds. And if we had the luxury of creating lockdowns to ensure that we flatten the curve, then many countries would have done so. Simply because the two viruses you talked about, if the second virus kills more people than the first virus, as in whether starvation will kill more people than corona, then you know that the measures you took in your country were actually ill-advised. And in some cities, it's probably more difficult to have social distancing than others because of the whole nature that many people have to earn their daily living by going out and getting income for food. In many other places in the developed world, I think it's easier because you have this social stimulus and food being provided. With limited resources and many people who are fighting for those resources, it becomes really tough how you divide. So the vulnerable population who need the social stimulus are the ones that many countries have to identify, look after them first.
Mm.
There's been talk about cash transfers. And, you know, with Kenya being a leader in M-Pesa and using mobile technology, I think we have a lot to share with the rest of the African countries as we embark and manage the cash transfer model for social stimulus. Now I'm getting more into the how. And obviously we would have to have the supplies for avoiding starvation ready to battle the second virus. So a delicate balance between the virus one and the virus two is where now the political leaders have to tread and manage this carefully.
Now, Dr. Takar, there are disturbing reports coming out of the People's Republic of China in terms of the manner in which the Chinese apparently are treating the African people who live mm-hmm. on their land. What is your reaction to that? You're talking about the China, which came of economic age, perhaps because of the help from Africa. You're talking about the China, which has since developed into the factory of the world. And part of the reason it has developed into the factory of the world is because it is the beneficiary of oil from Africa, from Nigeria, from Angola, and you name it. It is the beneficiary of copper and cobalt from the Democratic Republic of Congo, from Zambia, and you name it, they do not feel when it comes to oil or copper or cobalt or whatever other strategic mineral you can think of, including coltan. They do not see anything close to corona. But when it comes to the human beings who actually come from those specific countries or areas, somehow they see something like corona. What is your reaction to that? We're talking about very unnecessary stereotypes here, really.
I'm really, really appalled with that kind of behavior, not only by Chinese, but by any country, to any race, and to any groups. We should not say, and we should not blame any particular origin of people to be the ones that are either spreading the virus or are creating more transmission. Everyone must abide by the law. I must also say that laws in countries will differ from country to country. If you are in South Korea, Vietnam, India, USA, or Kenya, each country establishes a law. And you must follow the rule of law, whether it's mandatory quarantine, whether it's isolation, or whether it's social distancing. And no one should be spared, regardless of race, religion, or origin. So I believe that in the event that people from Africa are being targeted in China, it's truly appalling. We would not actually support any such action, and we should totally send back the message to China that this is not the kind of treatment that Africa deserves, especially given that Africa is such a huge partner of China.
African students and other African residents in the People's Republic of China, they have been tortured, mistreated. They have, in fact, been some of them evicted out of their apartments. I have read somewhere that when they enter into some of the public transportation systems, for example, like buses and trains, that the Chinese, in fact, walk out saying that they are basically going away, distancing themselves from corona, even though it seems to me that the corona, as a matter of fact, may have originated from Wuhan in China. What would you say about that?
What the coronavirus has done in China's case is exposed a racism that has always been there. And right now, someone has to be the scapegoat. And the African who was despised and hated and abused before corona now becomes the easy one to put out there. In fact, we know that the coronavirus pandemic started in Wuhan, in China. It was in this seafood and wet animal market, where I suspect the Africans were neither the sellers nor the buyers, because that's not generally the kind of stuff that they engage in. But now they become the victims. But they are lonely victims because their rulers back home on the continent really do not seem to care about them as much as they, the rulers, care about the money that comes out of the coltan and the oil and the gold and the diamonds and the rubber and whatnot. And so this is again a moment. This is a moment where we are going to see which of Africa's rulers fit the shoes of the great men who fought for independence. The leaders of Africa at independence who truly cared about the dignity of the African, the Kwame Nkrumahs, the Kenneth Kaundas, of course, Madiba, the last, I think, to me,
Nelson Mandela,
great African leaders, Nelson Mandela, these, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Julius Nyerere.
Sekou
Toure. These were leaders who cared about the dignity of the African.
What about
Sere Sekama? These people made mistakes, of course. Some of them became dictators when power corrupted them. So they had their hearts in the right place, and they did stand up. They stood up for the African. I would like to see the people who occupy their seats now do likewise, not in nice diplomatic language, but in very clear language that says, no, Beijing, you must protect our citizens, number one. Two, we are coming to get our citizens out of there.
What about your reaction to the United States government suspending its contribution to the World Health Organization based in Geneva and headed by an executive director who happens to be African?
I would like to really say that this is a very deep matter. It would need a bit of evidence. I think there are merits on both sides. I fully understand the United States trying to raise a flag about the concern. And the flag of concern is to WHO directly. WHO has a mandate and has been empowered by all of us in the world to ensure that they do not and take enough precaution to ensure that these pandemics don't spread in the way they did. Now look at the way SARS was managed previously, and maybe look at how Ebola was managed. So what happened to Corona? What did we not do right? And perhaps it was very deadly in the transmission, or it was too speedy. We are still learning about it. So did WHO do its best? Is a question that is worth investigating for sure. It's not about who is heading WHO. It's about, did they do the right things at the right time with the right speed? Now, we don't have enough evidence. If China, we realized this was, if we were given, okay, let me go back. Let's say we were in December right now, and we realized how dangerous or speedy this coronavirus is. We would have probably locked down travel long before Air France and other flights stopped. We would have not allowed Ethiopian Airlines to travel 32 times a week when the surge of coronavirus was increasing in February. So there are many mistakes in December, January, February that the World Health Organization may need to evaluate itself. But they did sound an alarm. They were very quick on the aspect of this is something that to be concerned about. And probably what US needs to reconsider is this is not the time to point fingers or find a scapegoat, but be part of the solution and not part of the problem. So I think US is behaving literally as part of the problem and not part of the solution. It needs to reverse that. I think they need to care about people more right now than funding WHO.
And on that note, our distinguished guests were Dr. Munimi Morera and Dr. Amit Thacker. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please, let's keep the African hope alive.